WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. With bases spread out across the world and a military budget that dwarfs that of any other nation, there is no doubt that America is now the global powerhouse. But author Chalmers Johnson warns that America has made the leap from powerhouse to military empire, and therefore risks the fate of all the empires that have gone before. Tonight on Point, Republic or Empire? America at the turning point. But first, former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling was named in a 42-count indictment unsealed today. He is the highest-profile Enron executive thus far to face criminal charges and is accused of participating in schemes to mislead government regulators and investors about Enron's earnings. Skilling was led to the Houston, Texas federal courthouse in handcuffs this morning, where he pleaded not guilty to all the charges. Michael France is covering the story for Business Week. I ask him exactly what those charges entail.
First and foremost, he's being charged with lying to shareholders, misrepresenting how well Enron is performing, telling the world that this failing company was doing great. Secondly, he's being accused of insider trading, which is taking advantage of the information he knew, which is that Enron was doing terribly, and then pulling out a fortune, millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, to enrich himself. Now, all in all, there's more than 40 counts, but those are the basic things he's being charged with.
Well, it certainly sounds serious.
It is. Well, it's extremely serious. He is essentially the poster boy for the entire corporate crime scandal. And on the basis of what they've charged him with, they could put him away, I'm certain, for two decades or more. This is one where there's so much visibility that I think in a lot of people's minds, even though the Enron Task Force, which is run by the Justice Department, has done quite well at getting all these lower-level people, I think that to a lot of people in the public, Jeff Skilling means more than all of the rest of them put together. In a lot of ways, I think a lot of people will interpret this and use this for a proxy as to how well the government's doing in its war on white-collar crime.
Well, Skilling's attorney says, not surprisingly, that his client is being made the scapegoat here. And you have to note that the indictment doesn't mention Ken Lay. Is there another big shoe that's going to drop in this case?
Well, potentially. I think the government would love to be able to indict Ken Lay as well. The difficulty is that even the case against Jeff Skilling is hard. And to take an analogy that I'm sure his attorneys would resist, the most difficult thing in the prosecution of, for instance, mob figures is always to get the guy at the top, because those people don't have their fingerprints on the actual wrongdoing. And that's somewhat the same thing that's going to be true with Skilling. Skilling is going to be a difficult person to put behind bars, and that'll even be more so with Ken Lay. So even though they would love to try to go after Ken Lay, it's still not clear to me nor to many other people who are watching this very closely whether or not they'll be able to do that.
Is there any indication, Michael, that the Enron's former CFO, Andrew Fasto, who is cooperating with federal prosecutors, helped the government build the case against Skilling, and so therefore perhaps Skilling might help build the case against Ken Lay?
Well, that's the plan. They're going to try to flip people, and if they can get Skilling, then I'm certain they'll try to enlist his help in getting Ken Lay. Now, the question is, what they're going to be able to give Jeff Skilling to get his cooperation, will it be worthwhile for them to give him a significant reduction in his sentence to do that? But that's certainly their strategy, to try and get all these people involved and to get them to testify. Now, the one thing I have to say, and this applies to both Skilling and to Ken Lay, there are not a whole lot of smoking gun documents out there, none really, that have come out so far, and we've seen millions of Enron documents where one of these two people is telling anyone else at Enron to do anything illegal. So you need these witnesses to kind of make up for the fact that we don't really have many documents right now.
And as you say, it could be a difficult case to make against him. His lawyers say, well, he just had to go with the information he was getting from his subordinates, you know, the lawyers and the accountants at Enron and so on.
Well, I think that's right. That is their defense. And there is some truth to that. They are going to be able to come up with a whole lot of documents where lawyers and accountants are telling Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay, this is perfectly legal. Now, if you believe something is legal, you can't be charged with a crime. So that's a very powerful defense.
And how much of a factor is it that Skilling did not invoke the Fifth Amendment when he was questioned by Congress in early 2002, unlike other top Enron officials? It almost does sound as if he's one of the people who's been willing to to be more forthright about this.
Well, he's really gutsy. I'll give him that. And I'll say something against conventional wisdom. I don't think he really hurt himself when he testified in the Senate, because he's a very, very sharp guy, and he didn't say anything that would get him into trouble. So even though that was a risky thing to do, and most people would not do it, I don't think he really harmed himself.
What would you say is the most damning piece of evidence against him?
The timing of his stock sales, and more important than that, the fact that he really has a reputation as a micromanager. And I think that what the government will be able to prove at trial was that Jeff Skilling knew every major deal that took place at Enron. And lots of people will say that he knew where every penny was that was coming in to this company. So ultimately, the most damning thing will be is that when Jeff Skilling says, he says, look, I'm the CEO. I can't possibly know everything that all the thousands of people at Enron are doing. And the government will say, well, granted, that's true, but you knew a lot, and you knew about the big problems, and you knew the really significant things that were happening. And in the end, I think that'll be the real obstacle he'll have.
Well, that's a hard case to make, isn't it?
I think it will be a difficult case. Contrast this to a case where a crime has been committed and there's a gun and a bullet in the body. It's not like that at all. There's nothing along these lines. So this will be harder than any of the Enron cases so far. I think it'll be more difficult than Martha Stewart. I think it'll be more difficult than the trial of the investment banker, Frank Quattrone. Of all the big white-collar criminal trials we've seen so far, I think this will be the most difficult one for the government.
And how much did Skilling actually make from the stock sales?
All in all, his profit appears to have been about $80 million. It's difficult to say exactly right now because it's hard to tell what price his options were exercised at. But his option sales appear to have netted him about $80 million, and he was probably well above $100 million when you add in his ordinary compensation.
What would be your best guess about whether he will actually wind up serving some time in jail?
My best guess, and this is based upon speaking to a lot of criminal law experts who've looked at this case very closely, is that he probably will, but it's a very close call. And the reason why people say that is not necessarily because the criminal case against him is so strong, but because you wouldn't really want to be Jeff Skilling right now in front of a jury. A lot of people, a lot of pundits, a lot of commentators have pretty much pronounced him guilty before proven innocent. So as a result, if he comes before a jury, he just has very much of an uphill struggle, even though technically he's going to have some very strong defenses.
But as you say, he's been painted now as the poster boy, and I wonder if he is convicted, if he does go to jail, will that be enough to quiet concerns about corporate fraud in America?
Yes and no. I think it will satisfy people that the mere fact that somebody was in the executive suite doesn't give them some pass to break the law. But on the other hand, we're really only one scandal away, or one series of scandals away, or the next scandal, which will inevitably happen, from people losing that faith all over again. The same thing happened in the 80s. You get a round of scandals. They solve those problems. New things are invented, and they solve those problems. I'm certain we'll see this cycle one more time.
So sending one guy to jail doesn't necessarily affect the big picture here.
Not really. I think it does help. But if anyone thinks this makes the markets absolutely and perfectly clean, they're wrong.
Michael Frantz, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Michael Frantz is a senior writer at Business Week. He spoke with me from New York. In his farewell address of 1961, President Dwight Eisenhower, commanding general of Allied forces in Europe during World War II, warned America to guard against the influence of a vast military-industrial complex. But too late, says Chalmers Johnson in his new book, The Sorrows of Empire. In it, Johnson asserts that in the 13 years since the end of the Cold War, America has experienced a revolution in its relationship to the rest of the world, and that during this time, a huge complex of interests, commitments, and projects were woven together into a new political culture that parallels civil society. In short, that America has become a military empire, and that if it doesn't change course soon, it will suffer the fate of every empire before it. Do you buy Chalmers Johnson's vision of America as a militant empire? Does the very idea of an American empire make you feel uneasy? How can the United States avoid going the way of all previous empires, from the Romans to the British? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Chalmers Johnson, Professor Emeritus and President of the Japan Policy Research Institute at the University of California, San Diego, and author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Welcome, Chalmers.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hi, Jack. Always a pleasure to have you here. Jack, are you hearing us all right? All right. We'll join Jack later, or he will join us later, more accurately, I should say. So, Chalmers, let me ask you first to define your terms, particularly as to the republic that we think we are versus the empire that you believe we've become, because I have to believe a lot of Americans would give you a vigorous argument on that point, you know, since that's really not the way we think of ourselves historically as an empire. We think of ourselves as a republic, you know, the good guys.
Certainly they would give you an argument. One of the reasons for writing this book, though, is to bring to the American public a vast amount of data that I'm reasonably certain they don't have, that I think they need badly in order to understand where we're going. Above all, the main topic that concerns me is the base world, the 725 military bases located in other people's countries. That 725 is the Pentagon's number in the base structure report published annually. It doesn't begin to be fully comprehensive. There's probably another 300 that are secret in one way or another. All of the espionage bases abroad, like Menwith Hill in England, that we use to listen to every email, every telephone call, every fax across the Atlantic. The bases in Israel, the bases in Afghanistan, the bases in Kyrgyzstan, the bases in Uzbekistan, these are all omitted. They list one Marine base in Okinawa when there's, in fact, well over 10 and a total of 38 American military bases in Okinawa. So that it's a complex thing, but what I'm trying to get at here is that these bases spread from Greenland to Australia, from Japan to Latin America, and in 130 different countries. Also, do bear in mind, there are no foreign troops based in the United States. That this constitutes a new kind of empire, that the modern equivalent of the colony is today the military base, and that these bases constitute a very special world of a half million American troops, dependents, spies, contractors, spread around the world. That they belong now to a professional army, that this is that is since 1973, it has not been an obligation of citizenship to serve in the armed forces. This is a career choice, a career choice often made by Americans seeking to escape from one or another dead end in American society. That's why the numbers of African Americans in the army is twice their percentage in the society. 50% of the women in the armed forces are national minorities. It's not necessarily a bad life. The military does everything it can to try to make this a comfortable career in order to keep people in the armed forces. Generally speaking, they do not expect to be shot at. Just take one example. When PFC Jessica Lynch was wounded at Nasiriyah, the press asked her later, after she recovered a bit, why did she join the Army? And she made the case that she couldn't get a job at Walmart in Palestine, West Virginia, that she'd essentially joined the Army to get a job and to get out of Palestine and to improve herself. That's true of any number of people that are in the armed forces today. But what I'm trying to do here is to introduce the concept empire and then also to link it with its historic Siamese twin, militarism. Militarism does not mean defense of the country.
All right.
Militarism,
well,
yes.
Yeah, I was just
Go
going
ahead.
To say you have set the table nicely for us. We're going to need to take a break in just a second.
Oh,
and
okay,
so we'll
fine.
Be back to explore this a little further and also whether we've gotten to this place deliberately or was it unintended consequences. We're talking this hour about whether America has become gradually the kind of military empire that presidents like Washington and Eisenhower warned us about. Does the idea of an American empire make you feel a little uneasy? How can the U.S. avoid going the way of all empires before it? And can we afford to be an empire? Is that America's fate, or can we still change course? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about whether America is moving, has moved from a republic to a military empire. Is that what you think? Do you believe America should be an empire? Does that idea make you a little queasy, or is it America's fate? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Chalmers Johnson, professor at the University of California, San Diego, and author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And Jack Beatty, I believe we have you on the line now.
Hi, Gail. Sorry, I wasn't available. The machine cut out.
Well, sometimes the technological gremlins get us, but we're happy you're here.
Thank you.
We were just talking before we took the break, Jack, about whether the place that Johnson sees us in right now is deliberate. Did we get there in a deliberate way, in a conscious way, or, Chalmers, was it a matter of unintended consequences?
It probably was unintended. Again, let me stress the subtitle here, though. Militarism, secrecy. Secrecy is indispensable to it. Even if we had an honest Congress, they can't do oversight on the Department of Defense. 40% of the budget is secret. All of the budgets of the intelligence agencies are secret. That is Article 1 of the Constitution that guarantees a statement on how our citizens' money is spent. Has not been true in the area of national defense since World War II, since the Manhattan Project to build atom bombs. It probably did just grow inadvertently, partly under cover of the Cold War, partly a sense that we needed hegemony over the world, but our hegemony was essentially benign. In recent years, it's gone beyond that, the warning of Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. It's here now with a vengeance. For those of you listening who are veterans of World War II, or as in my case of Korea or of Vietnam, service in the armed forces today is not something you'd recognize. You don't do KP anymore. You don't clean latrines. You don't do your laundry. That's all farmed out now to very lucrative contracts to companies like Kellogg Brown & Root, subsidiary of Vice President Cheney's Halliburton Corporation. Of the $57 billion just recently appropriated for the war in Iraq, a good third of it is going to private contractors to serve our troops overseas. I believe that the question of inadvertence is important here. It reminds us of the Roman Republic and its end, that it had rather inadvertently also acquired an empire around the Mediterranean and then discovered irreversibly, that empire has its companion, and that is militarism, standing armies that begin to have vested interests in the armies themselves, in their long service, in the way they're treated once they retire, in the amenities of life in the armed forces, and that this then led, in the case of the Roman Republic, which of course had enormous influence on as a model for our own republic, and both have lasted now about two centuries, that then this gave rise to people within the conservative world of Roman citizenry, but who now began to champion the rights of soldiers. This was, of course, most famously Julius Caesar, who was assassinated in the Senate in 44 BC, finally led to the rise of the young boy emperor, Octavian, who in 27 BC, the Roman Senate simply went out of business, turned over power to him. He became the god Augustus Caesar,
well, Chalmers,
and implemented military dictatorship.
Let's sort of fast forward to now, if we can, because you write about the four sorrows of empire, and I wonder if we could go through them one by one, see where we are, and
quickly,
and also perhaps avoid the consequences. Well, let me guide you through it, if you don't mind.
Okay,
let's start with number one, which is the issue of perpetual war. So how do you avoid that, particularly after the fact of September 11th? We were attacked.
Well, in the first place, the use of a high-tech armed force such as ours against terrorists is almost surely destined to fail. It has already failed rather badly. That part of the strategy of terrorism is to elicit a military overreaction that leads to a worst case. I mean, I offer just one. I mean, in the long, hard slog memorandum of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld in October, he said, we don't have a metric. The man is a stand-up comic. He means measure. But we don't have a metric for whether we're succeeding against terrorism. That's simply wrong. We have a quite good metric that between 1993 and 2001, including the attacks of 9/11, al-Qaeda carried out 5 major bombings globally. Since that time, in just 2 years, down to the suicide bombings in Istanbul against the HSBC Bank and the British consulate, they've carried out 17. There's no question that we're losing that war, and that the idea enunciated first by Vice President Cheney, there were 50 countries against which he felt we should bring about regime change through the use of our massive military. President Bush escalated that number up to 60 in his speech at West Point in 2002. That adds up to perpetual war, and the rest of the world, now having seen what happened in Iraq, is preparing for it.
Jack, what do you think?
Well, I think if you want to avoid that dire forecast, I think the imperative need is to prevent another terrorist attack on this country, because that will legitimate the endless war Professor Johnson is talking about, and that will hasten the kind of crackdown on civil liberties that parallels the Roman experience. And if you say to yourself, well, how do we prevent another terrorist attack on this country? Well, suppose American politics wasn't what it was, and you just looked at it as a problem. You'd probably say, going right out of the gate, well, by gosh, tomorrow we're going to have $1, maybe $2 a gallon gasoline tax. We're going to do this, and with that money, we're going to fund the biggest alternative energy project the world has ever seen, and we're going to break OPEC. And while we're doing that, we're going to put the arm severally on the Saudis, the Israelis, and the Egyptians. To the Saudis, we're going to say, if you keep supporting your madrasas around the world, you may find yourself in a state of near war with the United States of America. And by the way, your oil, you just have nothing there, because we're going to become independent of you. And you say to the Egyptians, you've got to stop the crackdown. You've got to let your opposition in. And you say to the Israelis, you can't use our money to perpetuate those settlements another day. You've got to bring them in, and we've got to have peace. You know, and then you'd get serious here. You'd tax the chemical companies so that they could pay for their own defense. You know, they could have the government defend them. The nuclear plants. We still only inspect 2% of the containers at the ports because the private interests lobbied the Bush administration. Oh, no, we don't want to pay for that. You'd get serious about it. And if you really got serious about it, you could perhaps stop terrorism. But on our current course, I'm just terribly afraid we will be struck here. And Tommy Franks, the general in charge of the Iraq operation, was quoted in the paper a few weeks ago saying, well, you know, if there's another attack on this country or more attacks, the military will have to get more involved in domestic security. That's scary.
Chalmers, you want to respond?
Yes. I mean, I agree with what he said. That is to say, we know a lot about terrorism and how to control it. The essential issue is to try and separate the active terrorists from their passive supporters then cause the passive supporters to identify them so that they can be arrested. It's essentially then a police problem. In order to make this separation, you must recognize the legitimate grievances of the passive supporters and alter your policies in such a way that you're responsive. I agree with Jack Beatty. The three things we should have done immediately after 9/11. First, withdraw the troops that we had in Saudi Arabia since 1991. They were not doing any good there. They were a festering sore. We did withdraw them after the fall of Baghdad. We should have done it faster. Secondly, we should have said, as a matter of national policy in the United States, we guarantee the ultimate existence of Israel. But by the same token, we are going to stop the $3 billion we give to Israel every year out of the defense budget until they end the settlements, which are simply a cancer destroying Israeli society and are also make it virtually impossible for us to be trusted anywhere in the Islamic world. And third, we have the technology today to have ended our dependence on Persian Gulf oil by simply fuel conservation for automobiles. We didn't do any of these things, though, and that's why it seems to me that the first sorrow that looms before us is more war. War has become extremely profitable. When it becomes that profitable, you can usually guess that we're going to see more of it.
And the second sorrow that you write about is a loss of democracy. Is there an alternative to that?
End of the republic. I mean, there's many examples you can offer, but let's just recall one: James Madison, by far the most important author of the Constitution, defending it in the Federalist Papers, where he always signed his name, Publius, first Roman consul. Madison wrote that the single most important article in the Constitution was the one giving the right to go to war exclusively to the elected representatives of the people. Never, he said, should it be given to a single person. The responsibility was too great. In October of 2002, our Congress, probably based on a false national intelligence estimate that was ordered to be written by the White House in order to defend the speeches made in the summer of 2002 by the president and vice president, the Congress voted to give that power to a single man when he felt like using it, including the use of nuclear weapons if he chose. And the following year, he did, in fact, use it without international sanction for what he was doing. As we talk, Articles 4 and 6 of the Bill of Rights are dead letters, habeas corpus and the right to be secure against illegal intrusions in your home. As it stands right now, the president has invented a new category. I'm not being facetious or cute when I say he's called it bad guy. He has arrogated to himself the power to declare a native-born American citizen a bad guy, and if he does so, he can lock him up in a naval prison in Charleston, South Carolina. We are about to find out whether the Supreme Court that appointed this president is prepared to take him on these issues. But you'd have an argument right now to say that the structure of government outlined in the Constitution of 1787 bears any resemblance at all to the government that exists in Washington, D.C.
All right. We have two more sorrows of empire to get to, but I also want to get our listeners in on the conversation. Let's go to Erie, Pennsylvania. I want to hear from Fred. Hi, Fred.
Hello. I had a point to make, but in listening into the conversation, I'll try to make this as quick as I can. I know Jack. I listen to this show religiously. I know Jack is definitely not a George Bush fan, and from the tone of the good professor, I can tell he's not a George Bush fan either. That's not to say that I am also, but. My point is, we live in a world today that is quite different from what the framers of the Constitution or Caesar Augustus could ever envision, and that's a few people with the wrong thing in their hands could wipe out a lot of people quick. Back in the days of the sword and the M1 carbine, that could never happen. Today it can. And I am not willing to give up any of my liberties that I enjoy in this country on one hand. But on the other hand, this thing needs to be thought through, because on NPR News today, I heard that they just found that the UN weapons inspectors just found some kind of uranium enriching process that they have there that was unbeknownst to anybody. That's a lot more... It's a lot scarier than what they thought they might have had. North Korea has nuclear weapons. Iran is right on the verge, I guess, of developing them. Pakistan, who knows who Pakistan sold them to? We're in a bad way, and we need to recognize that, and we need to react to it. I don't want to overstep our authority, or not even our authority, but I don't want to. That's a poor choice of words. I don't want to be the policeman of the world and the empire and the emperor of the world, but we need to address these problems.
Okay, Fred, appreciate the call, and we take your point. Jack, that's really the argument, isn't it? How do you balance that tension?
Well, I think Fred has identified the main challenge, the one the president talks about, terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, how to keep them apart. And, you know, take one example, the loose nukes in the former Soviet Union. There was a report out just a couple of weeks ago. I think it said something like, well, the tonnage, there are weapons, there's weapons-grade plutonium to the ton that we have still not purchased in the former Soviet Union. Now, it would seem to me, again, if you just were going to do this by let's just do what we have to do, you would get all that. You would buy it out now. You wouldn't wait 10 years to do it. You'd buy out all those scientists. And with Iran, you know, our European allies are actually starting to make a difference for us there, and we're beginning to appreciate that. And I thought, you know, on Fred's point about the we don't want to lose our liberties, I thought the most telling moment in the State of the Union speech was when the president said we want to renew the Patriot Act, and he received no applause from either side of the aisle. Republicans are worried about that, too. Liberty is not just something that liberals are worried about. So I think that there are a lot more breaks in our political culture on the kind of dire picture of, you know, our democracy just disappearing under the weight of, you know, draconian legislation.
And Chalmers, that's exactly the point you're making, isn't it? Of you know, how do you keep liberty in a time when we're facing so many problems in so many different places? And conveniently, we have this huge military apparatus that's poised and waiting.
Precisely. But let me try and say what we're talking about here, though, is blowback. It's a CIA term. Was invented after the first clandestine operation we ever carried out, and there's been hundreds of them since then, to overthrow the government of Iran in 1953 for the sake of the British Petroleum Company. Blowback means retaliation, but it means also retaliation for acts that were committed by our government and kept secret from the American public so that they have no way to put them in context when the retaliation occurs. We don't need 725 military bases abroad. We do not need the kind of anger against the United States that is bred in the places where we installed, for example, between 1967 and 1973, the Greek colonels, probably the most odious regime installed by either side throughout the Cold War. People who are thinking of going to Greece this summer for the Olympic Games ought to bear in mind that Greece is one of the most anti-American democracies on Earth. Another major anti-American democracy is South Korea. 101 American military bases there has finally just gotten on their nerves, living with the endless cycles of sexually violent crimes, hit-run accidents, environmental pollution, noise pollution committed by our forces, and also under laws they very conveniently write to make sure that they can't be held responsible for it. That's what I'm trying to say, is rather than just get scared to death about nuclear weapons out there, what we really need to do is to clean up our foreign policy quite consistently.
All right, we'll continue our discussion in just a moment after a break. We're talking this hour about whether America has become, bit by bit, the kind of military empire that presidents like Washington and Eisenhower warned us about. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about whether or not America has become a military empire. We're having the conversation with Chalmers Johnson, who is author of The Sorrows of Empire, and also with us is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And we have a couple more sorrows to get to, but first we want to get to our phone lines and hear from Bill, who's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill.
Good evening. Rarely have you had two guests, I'm referring to Jack Beatty and I forget the name of your other gentleman, who have been more on the point than these two gentlemen have been. I was in the Army. I entered in 1968. Once I left college and once I was in the National Guard at the time, I went active duty and I got my commission, and I never went overseas, by the way. But it was at a time when the Army was going to go all professional, and the thought chilled me for the reasons that your guest brought up. I wanted people in the service that didn't want to be in the service and that would question things. And the thought that you would have professional people that would not occasionally question things was a very disturbing development. There is no question in my mind that this is not something that's a healthy development in all the years that it's been in the transition. We're coming to the point where we're having something of a presidential dictator, somebody who feels that he can do without the oath of office that he freely takes. He dispenses with due process of law. That's one of the casualties. He can redefine what laws he will or will not obey. There's another factor here that also disturbs me, and it was one that disturbed me at the time of the Vietnam War. There was a feeling at that point that my father's generation and previous generations had this attitude that citizens owe something to their country. And military service at that time was one of those things that they owed. And I had assumed that even at that particular time. I mean, I was in college, but I was an aberration. I was surrounded by people in my college classes who didn't have that same feeling. We have citizens today who don't feel that they owe their country anything. It's more like, what can you do for us? This is like, as long as you keep us safe, we're not going to question. We also have a citizen body that has no concept of its own past history. I'd be willing to bet you that most Americans out there truly believe they know something about their country's past. You start asking them basic questions, they don't have a clue.
All right, Bill, we take your point and appreciate your call. We've got a couple more of these sorrows that I really do want to get to, and actually one of our callers can perhaps help us with one, although a little bit out of order. David's on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. David, what's the point you wanted to make?
Well, thank you for having me on. And Professor Johnson, I read Blowback, and it was quite an eye-opener. And I think certainly what you're discussing with regard to foreign policy, the section that I read on South Korea, and I think if most people knew how much we manipulated South Korean politics to our own ends, they'd probably be quite surprised. But the question I have, do we know, or does anybody know, or has anybody ever calculated, how much money has been spent on the military and the defense infrastructure of this country since World War II? And the second question I have is, how much of tax revenue, I'm talking about tax revenue taken in, not Social Security spending, what we grab out of that bag, but just annual revenue taken in tax collection, sales, income tax, is spent on the military infrastructure?
Good question, David. And also, Chalmers, as I ask you to answer that,
yes.
One of the other points you make is your fear of America going into bankruptcy because the military is essentially taking all the money.
That's the fourth sorrow. I mean, very well said. That even if the citizens are willing to forget about their constitution because they're so been scared to death by the president, that we are unable to defend ourselves with easily the world's largest and most powerful military that ever came along. Bankruptcy is something that will create a crisis no matter what. As Herb Stein, when he was a Republican chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, once said, things that can't go on forever don't. That's about the situation we have today. We have $500 billion annual military budgets now, $400 billion for the Department of Defense alone, another indeterminate amount, $75 billion probably for Iraq and Afghanistan that are not included, another $20 billion in the Department of Energy for atomic energy. It adds up to $500 billion. As for the amount spent since World War II, it is simply staggering. I mean, one has to be candid about this. For politically well-connected capitalists, the way to make lots of money rapidly is in servicing the military-industrial complex, not just weapons manufacturers, though Lockheed Martin's profit rate last year was extremely good, but in the wonderful burgeoning new world of private military companies that do everything for our military but pull the trigger. This is extremely controversial within the officer corps. They believe that it's destroying much of the internal esprit de corps of the military. Let me just say, I agree entirely with the earlier caller, too, on the dangers of what's happening in our armed forces. It leads, after a while, to the attractions of military populism, of a Julius Caesar, a Napoleon Bonaparte, a Juan Perón. Our president, the current president, has devoted virtually every public speech he has given since he came to office to talking to uniformed troops brought in by their commanders and seated in front of them and told, cheer. Perhaps they do cheer. that they're pleased to see him. But it's also, anybody is fairly well aware that this is a reasonably rigged operation and not exactly what we would call democratic. I'm trying to say, trying to spell out, and I'm not alone here, by the way, that we're walking on thin ice. I would just refer to the sort of brilliant speeches being given virtually daily by the elderly Senate Robert Byrd, senator from West Virginia, to empty Senate chambers, calling attention to the enormous threats to our Constitution right now. He is rather our Cicero. I don't think he will end up like Cicero. I think he will probably just be ignored and go to his grave. Cicero, of course, ended up with his head and both hands nailed to the Forum wall by the then-rising military populist Octavian.
Jack, I want to hear from you on this as well. How thin is that ice from a fiscal perspective?
Pretty thin. I mean, Larry Korb, Reagan's Assistant Secretary of Defense, calculated that the Cold War cost $8 trillion. Suppose it had only cost $4 and the other $4 had been spent here. Private business, spent in public services. What a different country this would be. That's what's at stake here, you know. I mean, you can do one thing or you can do another. And one of the costs of empire has always been that the people at home have suffered. You know, the British working class did not get anything out of the empire.
Yes.
Except a kind of pride. And it was only when they got rid of the empire that the British began to have a better life. And, you know, just to go back to our caller, Bill, I think he put his finger on it. I think anyone who wants peace, or who wants a step back from militarism should night and day work for a universal draft. No student deferment allows, such that it would touch the son of every politician, son and daughter of every politician, and especially every opinion columnist. You would find dramatic changes in what people think we should do with our forces.
Well, we just have a few seconds left, so unfortunately we won't be able to get into the third sorrow, but I'll give you a hint. It's about truthfulness becoming propaganda, and you can read more about it in Chalmers Johnson's book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. Professor Johnson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be on your program.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, was On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And you can continue the conversation online. You can go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Kofi Annan and Paul Bremer hold fast to the planned June 30th U.S. handover of power in Iraq. This is On Point. Prospects for early elections in Iraq faded today, as did hopes for direct elections held by Iraq's Shia majority. Shia leader Ayatollah Ali al-Histani had raised some serious objections against U.S. plans for regional meetings to select a new Iraqi government, with nationwide elections postponed until at least the end of 2005. In response to Sistani's concerns, the Coalition Provisional Authority asked the UN to draft alternate proposals for Iraq's political future. Today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan offered a preliminary answer, yes to the planned June 30th handover of power, no to direct elections before then.
We hope that as we move forward, we'll be able to work with the Iraqis and the coalition to find a mechanism for establishing a caretaker or an interim government until such time that elections are organized. But we shared with them our sense and the emerging consensus or understanding that elections cannot be held before end of June, that the June 30th date for handover of sovereignty must be respected, and that we need to find a mechanism to create a caretaker government and then help prepare the elections sometime later in the future.
Again, that was UN Secretary General Kofi Annan speaking in New York this afternoon. Annan's full report on the process for installing a sovereign government in Iraq is due next week. Paul Bremer, the chief U.S. administrator in Iraq, also spoke today, and he stressed that the U.S. remains strongly committed to transferring sovereignty to the Iraqis on June 30th.
There are 133 days before sovereignty returns to an Iraqi government on June 30th. Changes in the mechanism for forming an interim government are possible, but the date holds. And hold it should. In the November 15th agreement, the Governing Council and the coalition promised the Iraqi people sovereignty on a date certain, and we will give it to them. There will be 100,000 American troops and tens of thousands of coalition forces still here until such time as the Iraqi security forces are able to assure their own security, which will not be as early as July. So the major change that happens on June 30th is that the coalition authority passes sovereignty back to the Iraqi government. The occupation ends, and coalition forces are no longer occupying forces. They are in partnership with the Iraqi people to protect Iraqi security. The president has said repeatedly that we are not going to leave Iraq until we finish the job. And the job is very clearly defined as having a democratic, stable Iraq at peace with itself and with its neighbors. So America will still be here. Many of the coalition countries, I hope all of them will still be here, perhaps more. We are certainly not going to abandon Iraq.
And that was Paul Bremer, the chief U.S. administrator in Iraq, speaking today in Baghdad. And we're joined once again this evening by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. So, Jack, it looks as if the Shia majority aren't going to get exactly what they wanted, early direct elections, at least for now. What do you see the follow-on from that? What complications might that cause?
Well, it was getting a little dicey there. I mean, just last week, the Shia and the Kurds were talking about having, they said, well, our regions of the country are stable. There isn't much terrorism in the south. There's not much terrorism in the north under the Kurds. We will have elections, and we will sort of cut the Sunni triangle out of it, and they can have maybe caucuses or something, but they'll have their elections later when order is restored. That was going to really cause problems. The Sunni were not going to like that at all, and it looked That looks scary. Now, I don't know how they're going to, you know, whether there's going to be a climb down here by the Shia and Kurds on this or what. But here's a case where that UN, much despised UN, talking shop, I think it's been called by some right-wing commentators, its good offices are really helping the United States now. They are legitimating. This world body is legitimating the U.S. desire to hold elections, I mean, to put off the elections for another year. And that is invaluable for us on the ground in Iraq. And we owe the UN a debt of thanks, I think, here.
Well, and we owe you a debt of thanks, Jack Beatty, as always. Appreciate your being here with us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, Johnette Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoog, with help from Michael Garth and Darren Mnuchin. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.